Okay, so my name is Luis Santos, and in spite of the fact that it's a Spanish name, I'm Spanish, yes. I live in Germany and work in Germany since some time, several years, and now I'm working at the University of Hanover. So I would like to tell you today some general comments about condensed matter with cold gases, different scenarios and control tools. I am not a member of the community of condensed matter, so to say. I'm more a member of this big community, which is called cold gases, and I will try to give this talk from this perspective, stressing also this issue of the control tools. So in this sense, I would like to thank the organizers and also Victor for the opportunity to talk with people of condensed matter here and to interchange some ideas. Okay, so the field of cold gases is a field which has undergone several phase transitions during the last years. And let me just comment about that just in order to understand some things. So the field of cold gases started as a field mainly of quantum optics and atomic physics, which is where I started, so to say. And because it involves this the analysis of different cooling and trapping mechanisms, which are actually in the basis of the physics of ultra-cold gases, and actually in the basis of why we can talk nowadays about things as strongly interacting systems with cold gases. These were the methods of laser cooling and trapping of neutral atoms. And this was mainly in the 80s and 90s. And then in the middle of the 90s, in the beginning of the 90s, middle of the 90s, then the cooling progressed to such a point in which atoms develop matter wave behavior, and this is what is called atom optics, which is still something which is pretty active, field which is pretty active, especially in atom interferometry and precision measurements, etc. But it also leads, as we know very well, to the Bose-Einstein condensation and to the achievement of Fermi degeneracy. And then there was a first phase transition. And the second phase transition was to strongly interacting systems, which is why we are here, which are very different systems, like gases with large scattering length, rotating gases, lattice gases, or one-dimensional gases. So the community of cold gases really made all these phase transitions, or tried to make these phase transitions as best as we can. So this community is a community in which theory and experiments have been going side by side, at least until reaching this point of here. And this is a point that I would like to stress here, because I think that this is an important point that we could perhaps discuss at some point, which is the matching between some theoretical ideas of strong interacting systems and the reality of experiments nowadays. Because I think that there is a mismatch nowadays, and this can be dangerous at some point. So it's not that I am pessimistic, but the one has to be realistic also about some things. And in this sense, I like very much, and I think we could comment more about the recent papers of Jason Ho and you, about temperature issues and about this sort of things. Okay. So, first, when you see this red star, this is control mechanism, yes? So the first control mechanism, of course, and this is one of the main systems where you can find condensed matter behavior in ultra-cold gases, is, of course, that we can put atoms in an optical lattice, which is just two counter-propagating lasers, and through the dipole force, you are able to generate a periodic potential, which is, in principle, perfect. You have a perfect lattice, there is no defects, there is no phonons, and this is a system at very low temperature. So this is a periodic system with a band structure and so on. And this is a system in which you can have also, of course, interactions, which make the life more interesting. And in typical experiments up to now, the atoms interact just via short-range isotropic interactions, where this, which is something like that, C6, C12 potential, where the interaction at very, very low energies, which is the case here, is provided by the S-wave scattering length, A. So you can substitute the potential by a pseudo-potential, which provides the same asymptotic behavior. This A, and this is another mechanism of control, can be changed by means of scattering resonances, so-called Feshbach resonances, but there are other sorts of resonances like optical resonances, or which were proposed mainly by Jora, who is not here, he's in the East Coast now. And there are other ways which, for example, you can change the scattering by confining strongly in one direction or in two directions. Okay, so this you know well. So if you are in the lowest band of the problem, then you can reduce your the physics of the problem to the Haber-Hamiltonian, where you have some tunneling, you have some interactions. On-site interactions, you have some chemical potential which is controlling the number of atoms. And here you can have two phases, the superfluid phase and the Mott-insulator phase. And these are actually the experiments on the Mott-insulator phase just 4 or 5 years ago were the smoking gun for the start of the field of cold gases with meets condensed matter. So it's just 5 years ago for us. For you guys of condensed matter, probably 20 years ago for some of you. But for the people of cold gases, this is really something which is pretty new, and we are really learning every day. And this is one of the reasons we are here. Okay. Another important issue that you have in optical lattices is that you have an overall harmonic potential here, which is confining the atoms, which is inducing a local chemical potential. And this makes that the phases that you have here are actually spatially localized phases. So because basically you cut the phase diagram, this chemical potential versus tunneling, you scan different values of the chemical potential, and therefore you can have different regions of Mott-insulator, superfluid, and so on. Okay, so this is the basic thing, and now let's try to add things. For example, let's try to add disorder. In principle, I have said that you can have a perfect lattice in principle, but in principle you can also engineer disorder, and you can engineer disorder in different ways. You can engineer disorder in the chemical potential, for example, and there are several ways to do that. One way is to use the speckle. Speckle is, if you just look closer to there, this is these points that you see when you imping with a laser through to our rugose surface, yes? And this is due to the interference between different points at the surface. This produces a random pattern of light, which is translated into a random potential for the atoms. This has been done in several experiments.
So what about the time dependence of that? Is that static?
This is static for these experiments, yes. So you have a given diffusion, and this again diffusion, would you pass the laser through it, and this gives a pattern which is basically static and basically reproducible for these experiments.
So in the laser, probably because of the air movement.
No, this is due to the rugose surface actually. At also the rugose surface of my hand, you can see the points there.
Yes, but if there are movement,
okay, just if there is air, just these experiments are done fortunately in vacuum. But this is one possibility of control. Other possibility is just that you take your optical lattice, you put lasers with different, with incommensurable frequencies, for example, spatial frequencies with respect to this one, and you generate pseudo disorder. And if you want to generate more disorder, you put even more input lasers. And there are other ways which have been proposed recently. Of course, if you induce disorder in this way, you can induce a random bounded disorder, which was studied in the seminal paper of Fischer et al. In 1989. So you induce some random disorder here, some random chemical potential, sorry. And then it's very easy to understand what you have here, because if you have zero tunneling, so if this is zero, these energies are local, and you just have to minimize this energy with respect to the occupation, And then you see that if you are in this regime, you have a given number of atoms for all these values of the chemical potential. But if you are between this value and this value, the chemical when you increase the chemical potential, you increase the number of atoms. So this means that this phase is actually an insulating phase, but is not a Mott-insulator because it has a finite compressibility. There's no gap in the excitations, and actually you make a zoom to small values of the tunneling, then you see that you open these gaps, which are actually these regions, between Mott insulator regions, just the Bose class. And actually, it seems from careful Monte Carlo calculations that the Bose class really separates the Mott insulator from the superfluid. Okay, there have been recent experiments in Florence. It seems to observe, or at least to give a trace, that there could be a Bose class in this transition in these experiments. Okay, another possibility of control that you have in these systems is to induce disorder in the interactions. This is something different, which was a proposal that we did some time ago, which consists in the following. As I commented to you, you can control the interactions in your system by means of resonances. One of these resonances is the so-called Feshbach resonance, which basically means that you can change this is the magnetic field in this axis, and for some values of the magnetic field, you have a resonance between different molecular potentials, which give you a very large variation of the interactions in your system. Basically, your scattering length goes from positive infinite to negative infinite. There. So if you place yourself with an offset magnetic field close to this Feshbach resonance, but not crossing the resonance, then a small change in the magnetic field can lead to large variations of the interactions. And the slight modifications of the magnetic field can be achieved at something which is called an atom chip. So basically, you place yourself close to a chip, and random variations of microscopic variations of the current, long wires here, can lead to microscopic variations of the very small variations of the magnetic field, which in turn, if you are close to a Feshbach resonance, can lead to large variations of the interaction.
So again, same question. This, when you say random, you mean random only in space or in space?
In space.
What does
time mechanism? Also in this case, no, because current fluctuates and then you get also.
But not at the scale that we are considering here, because actually what you have in these systems is actually the formation of some sort of domains in which the current is variated, and these domains are actually very reproducible, and this is the basis of something which has been called the fragmentation of condensates, for example, and you see always the same pattern. Basically, you get that your magnetic field pattern is always the same.
But what is the origin of
this? This is something which is not completely clear, yeah, in the chips. But actually, if you look to this chip realization, you always get the same pattern. So it's a sort.
Do you think it's because ideal?
There is a work of Eugene Demler's group in which they say that it's also due to the fact that these wires are meandering, for example. And this is something which is characteristic of this, of every wire, so to say. Okay? If you change the wire, then you will change, experimentally, so to say, you will have another random generation of this.
So in principle, you could measure the distribution of local fields.
And there is some experiments in the group of Jörg Schmidmeier, who is this guy, who have studied very slight variations of the magnetic field in these wires. Spatial variations.
How do they do it?
By measuring the behavior of condensates in these wires.
Experiment, did you change the field from side to side? What's the correlation?
This is a different issue which I don't want to touch here because we didn't have a look closely to that. But actually, you have to be sufficiently close to the chip in order to have random noise, really random noise from side to side. Actually, you can approach this to the chip at most as half a micron or something like that, which because otherwise you will have van der Waals adsorption, for example, and things like that. And this means that the randomness, which is indicated here, can be, so to say, the typical wavelength of the randomness is of the order of half a micron, which could be of the order of the lattice that you are using. But typically, you will be willing to be higher than that in order to avoid problems, and therefore you will have some correlations in the noise. Yeah. So, as I say, this experiment is in principle possible. It's not done. It's not an experiment. But one has to also, if one wants to make a real quantitative analysis of this, one should have a look to also to correlations in this problem. But if you use the mechanism that I was commenting before, then you will have a Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian where these interactions are random now, from side to side, in principle. Of course, what happens, again, if you have correlations, is a different piece. And in principle, you can have randomness here without having randomness here, because these variations of the chemical potential will which are produced by the variations of the magnetic field are very, very small, because you can have very small variations of the magnetic field, and still, so this will be very small, but this can be very large if you are close to first order. So you can have a bounded random disorder between this guy, between these two values, and this disorder now is nonlinear. So let's see why. So you have, let's see what happens at zero tunneling. This is zero tunneling, and this is the chemical potential here going. So at random chemical potential, you have a Bose-glass phase, as I commented before, between these two values. So this means that you have a Bose-glass at very small chemical potential, and then you have all these islands of Bose-glass between the different Mott insulator regions. In the case of the random view, the equivalent of this disorder is this value here. Just if we want to see it in this rough way. So this means that this disorder is nonlinear, and in particular, it depends on the number of atoms that you have there. So, of course, if there is no atoms, and this is what happens at zero chemical potential, at zero tunneling, then there is no noise. Then the Bose-glass, first Bose-glass phase is of this width, of 2 epsilon in this case. The second one will be 4 epsilon, and the third one will be 6 epsilon, and so on. And eventually, for some sufficiently large number of atoms per side, you will wash out the Mott insulator regions. So actually, you have a sort of hybrid regime between a slight disorder and a large disorder in this system. So between a system in which you have just Bose-glass and superfluid, and a system in which you have still Mott insulator, Bose-glass, and superfluid. This is what happens at zero tunneling, and at finite tunneling, you can really see this. We have had a look to this problem with quantum Monte Carlo calculations by Stefan Bessel, and some strong coupling expansion calculation. And these are the results. These are the lobes of the Mott insulator here, and this is the boundary between the Bose-glass and the superfluid. This is a one-dimensional case. Yes.
Actually, we have a program participant who claims to have solved that model exactly.
Very good. This will be very interesting.
Gil Raphael, and I think the paper is unpublished. And as far as I'm, he was just telling me about it yesterday. So as far as I remember, he's getting both glass phase regardless of whether you are either random or not.
So he has a both glass phase regardless.
Regardless of whether you are random or not. So the important thing is that. Mu i
is are random, or?
Yes, mu i is are random.
Yes.
And for him, u i is and even j i is are random. So he can turn on all possible randomness.
So he solved it for all cases of randomness?
Yes. But right. All cases of randomness. Well, no, it's not exact, but it's.
Because there have been some works of people of Harvard, I think. Anatoly Polkovnikov. They have been working in this model, but as it is done in a lot of papers of quantum Monte Carlo, actually, also by Svistunov and Prokofiev, they take into account the limit of high occupation numbers first of all and commensurable. In that case, you can map the Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian to another Hamiltonian, which is apparently easier to solve with quantum Monte Carlo, quantum phase model. But this does not, of course, reproduce what happens at very small occupation, which is actually a key point here, because if you go to higher occupation, then you just have Bose-glass and superfluid, basically, in this case. So in this case, it's very important what happens at small filling factor, right? Other thing which is interesting here, apart from the fact that you wipe out the Bose-glass, the Mott insulator regions, is what happens at the lowest boundary of the Mott insulator. Because here the occupation is between 0 and 1, basically. So you have very rarely sites occupied by 2. So this means that the noise in the interaction is not up, is not present there. So basically, this all this line, I mean, it's very difficult to say whether we have a non-trivial critical point here, because for any practical purposes, basically these points of here will be like tricritical, because you will have like a Bose glass, Mott insulator, and superfluid basically living in the same. Experimentally speaking, this I think it will be very difficult to discern. This is in the quantum mechanical calculations is what's not possible to see. So all these the black dots here are the points which separate the Mott from the from the Bose glass, and the reds are the points which separate the Bose glass from the superfluid. So you see that they are really very close to each other in this in this region.
This is only for disorder in U, right?
This is for the disorder in U only. There is no disorder in the chemical potential for the, in this analysis. Also, of course, like in other problems with disorder, this is a problem which is which converts very slowly to the thermodynamic limit, because it's dominated basically by regions of accidental order, basically. Okay, so this is the disorder business, and now let me point. So this is. In this sense, I have destroyed this beautiful periodicity of the lattice there. And now I will also affect the interactions. Because as I told to you up to now, there is just experiments, basically all the experiments up to now, except a few of them, are with atoms or molecules which interact via short-range interactions. The sort of van der Waals-like interactions. But there is a new generation of experiments which is appearing now, in which the dipole-dipole interaction can play a significant or even dominant role eventually. One of them is atoms with large magnetic moment, and in particular chromium, which has 6 Bohr magnetons, which is quite large in comparison with other atoms. And this is particularly important because it's the only experiment up to now with a quantum degenerate gas in which the dipole-dipole interaction can play a significant role. Other systems include Rydberg atoms, because if you go to a large quantum number n, the dipole-dipole interaction goes with n to the power 4 because the dipole goes with n to the power 2. So this can be pretty large. And another possibility is polar molecules. There have been a lot of activity in this context. because if you are able to put your molecule in the lowest vibrational mode, then you will have a very large dipolar moment. Unfortunately, for the moment, there is no experiment with quantum degenerate gases for these systems. And it seems relatively difficult, although possible in the next future, but relatively difficult to put, for example, molecules in the lowest vibrational mode. Okay, in these dipolar gases, as I say, the dipole-dipole interaction can play a significant or even dominant role. This dipole-dipole interaction, contrary to the van der Waals one, is long range. And it's anisotropic, so it's partially attractive and partially repulsive. So this theta is, of course, the angle between the vector which joins the two atoms and the dipole orientation, because I assume that the dipoles are oriented by some external field. Actually, this external field opens another tool of control for dipolar gases, which is actually not my idea, the idea of Stefano Giovannazzi, Axel Görlitz, and Tillmann, Pfau, which is something very easy to understand. If you take your dipoles, which are oriented by some given magnetic field, for example, now you begin to rotate the magnetic field with a given angle with respect to the z direction, for example, and you do it sufficiently slow in such a way that all your dipoles are following the motion, which is the Larmor. You have to do it slower than the Larmor precession. But you do it fast enough, in such a way that your system integrates, then what you get is, this is the dipole in the square, basically, you get a prefactor here, which can change the sign of your interaction, which is the important point here. So basically, you will go from a dipolar interaction, which is just dipole in the square, to a dipolar interaction, which is minus the dipole in the square divided by 2. So this means that you can change the sign of the interaction, and you can pass from this configuration, which is attractive, repulsive, which is the usual one, to a repulsive, attractive one. It's not as spectacular as the Feshbach resonance, for example, which is you can make your interactions infinitely big, but it can change the sign of the interaction, which is an a very useful tool for some things that I will say later. Yes, the arrows are the same because basically I take that this Z direction as my arrow, so to say. But since I am rotating, I can rotate like this, yes? And this means that I can change the prefactor here. But this line here is just determining this angle here, okay? So the important point is that I make my dipolar interaction attractive on the plane and repulsive in this direction, which is quite important. Also, to simplify the life of a theoretician for some things. Okay, the dipolar gases offer a lot of interesting new physics, and for the moment only this small box here has been checked experimentally. For example, how a dipolar gas expands depends on the dipolar orientation, and this is the first trace of dipolar effects ever observed in quantum gases, and it has been done in the group of Tillmann, Pfau in Stuttgart. The stability of these gases depends on the trap. You can have multidimensional solitons, but I will not enter into all the details. You have fermionic dipolar gases, in which you can have interesting physics. This could be commented better by Jora. There have been quantum information ideas also in how to implement fast quantum gates with dipolar gases. And of course, you can have interesting physics with strong interacting systems, and I will comment about this. Other interesting thing that you have in dipolar gases is in the excitation spectrum here. And I would like to make a point here, because suppose that you have a plane. Just you compress very much your gas in this direction, you have a two-dimensional infinite plane in principle. Then you can analyze how is the energy as a function of the momentum of plane waves in this system. So you want to calculate the dispersion law. And this dispersion law for a weakly interacting system shows a phonon quadratic dependence of this famous Bogoliubov spectrum. If you include the dipole-dipole interaction and the dipole-dipole interaction is sufficiently strong, then you can have a rotten feature here, a minimum here. And the reason for this is in the momentum dependence of the dipole-dipole interaction. So for some momenta, the dipole-dipole interaction can become can reduce the energy of the system, and this is why you have for some finite momenta here, you will have this minimum.
This is in two dimensions?
This is for a two-dimensional case, but it's also true in one dimension.
But you
don't have that in three dimensions. No. Exactly. But this is the point that I would like to make here. Because one of the interesting things that you can have in cold gases in general is that you can rotate them. So perhaps, can you see it?
Yeah.
So, you can have your gas, let's suppose an infinite gas, and now you rotate it around a given line, and this is the vortex line. In short-range interacting, this vortex line has actually a given width, which is the so-called vortex core, which is proportional to the healing length. It's basically the healing length of the problem. And the healing length goes with the square root of the interaction, so which is this coupling constant, let's call it G times length. This G, or let's put it the scattering length here. Goes of this of this form. Now, if you have a straight vortex line, for a lot of things in short-range interacting systems, you can study the physics of these vortices, or many of the physics of these vortices, by just analyzing what happens in a slice, yes, of it, in a slice. And the reason is because the short-range interaction is local. Yes, it's just concentrated in a given point, it's local. However, in the dipole-dipole interaction, you will have that the gas, which is here, is affecting this position in here. Because you have a long-range interaction between different points. And this makes a big difference, yes? Between this makes the vortices in dipolar gases more three-dimensionally important, in some sense. Because if you are in three dimensions, you can calculate, and I have no trap here, that the effect of the dipolar interaction is basically to regularize the coupling constant here, to some effective coupling constant, which is smaller actually than the coupling constant that you have in the absence of the dipolar interaction in three dimensions. So this means that the healing length is bigger, and therefore my vortex core is bigger also. In two dimensions, the effective dipole-dipole interaction, so if you just compress your system to two dimensions, the effective dipole-dipole interaction is actually bigger than the, so the effective coupling constant that you have here will be some your short range coupling constant plus something, so which is bigger. So this means that the healing length, so here the healing length is bigger, and here the healing length is smaller. So this means that the vortex cores, so if I take a vortex line and I begin to compress here, I will change the shape of the vortex core, which is something which is, of course, if you keep your density constant, is something that this does not happen in solid-rich interacting system. But this is not the point that I would like to make here. The point that I would like to make is that the vortex lines are actually not straight, but can have some modulations. These modulations are the so-called Kelvin modes. If you have a given wavelength and therefore a given spatial momentum here, then you can calculate which is the energy, so the dispersion law of these Kelvin modes, and this is something which is known since a long time. And you see that this dispersion law follows this K square log depends, where this is the healing length. Okay? So actually you have something which has this dependence and then it goes quadratic. So here is K square log. And here is K square. The point is that if now you have a dipole-dipole interaction which is negative on the plane during this tuning that I was commenting to you, and positive in this direction, when you perform this motion of here, when you make this modulation in here, what you actually do is to decrease the dipole-dipole interaction. The reason is because you can understand this vortex line as dipolar holes, basically, which are like a chain of dipolar holes. If now you displace your dipolar holes, and the dipole-dipole interaction is negative on the plane, then you see that you, by doing this, you are reducing the energy, the dipole-dipole energy, right? So once more, the vortex line is like a chain. It's like a chain of, like a collar, yes, of dipolar holes, if you want to understand it in this way. So if you perform this motion, now you are changing the angle, the relative angle between these dipolar holes. And since this interaction, I have changed the sign of the interaction by doing this tuning, this means that I can reduce the energy of the system by the dipole-dipole energy of the system by doing this motion. And this leads to a minimum here, which is this proton that appears here.
Let me just say, yes. You say you do this tuning, that's this thing about making these spins
yes.
With the external field. And then, so you do the tuning, and then you look at the excitation mode somehow.
I do this tuning, but this tuning is done in such a way so fast that I can integrate it out. It's a scale of time which is not appearing.
It changes the effective
dipole-dipole interaction.
Sign of it.
Exactly. It makes it negative on the plane and positive in the axis.
So it's sort of leading to some kind of instability, that's what you're saying.
Exactly. It leads to a rotom, and if the dipole is sufficiently strong, the rotom can touch zero, and it will lead to some sort of new, possible new ground state. Because actually what happens when the... This is a different sort of roton than this one, which occurs here. Here you have a phonon roton here, and here you have a Kelvin roton. This is a different thing. And it's also very different, the scales at which this occurs. Because I believe that whether this is not possible to observe possibly with chromium, this is very possible, because actually here, you don't have to compare the dipolar interaction with your short range interaction, which is leading to this phonon here, but you have to compare the dipolar interaction with the kinetic energy, which is much smaller, which is what's giving you the Kelvin.
So when do the minimum of the rotation here? So what is the scale for the K of the rotation?
This scale of here is actually also changing with this is in the units of this Hilly length. But in the units of this Hilly length, this scale is basically universal. We didn't study up to now which is this scale, so to say.
So it's a competition between
the kinetic energy. But not the short range interaction and the dipolar interaction, but the kinetic energy and the dipolar interaction. And this is a very different scale, because typically you need to have this rotation here, you need that the dipolar interaction and the short range interaction are comparable, which is not what happens in chromium.
No. In the first case, I think the rotation minimum is just a few weeks of all the inverse of the thickness. So.
Exactly. Here there is nothing like this, but what sets the scale here of units is the Hilly length, which is the only scale that you have available in this problem, because I don't have any trap or whatever.
You get Hilly length by comparing interactions and kinetic energy. And you said interactions play no role. I mean, not dipolar, but point-like interactions.
Exactly.
If they play no role, then...
They play a role, but the only role is in the scale of the momenta which occur here. This is the only place where they play a role, because actually the only place where they play a role is in the size of the core. This is the only place where they play a role.
Why does it give a rotation and not just rescale the Kelvin?
The reason is because the only effect is not just to rescale, to change the Hilly length here, but there is an additional effect. So if you calculate the Bogoliubov equations, you will have a rescaling of your G, but you will have an additional term which is non-local, which is momentum dependent. And this is where it happens, this rotation here.
You can imagine driving this mode soft. Is that possible? And then having a transition into a different ground state, what would that be?
I don't know. But so for example, in this particular case, from the studies that Jora has been doing in the last couple of years, it's very probable that what you have is a sort of transient super solid which will collapse into local collapses. So you will generate more and more harmonics, and then it will collapse. In this case, I'm not completely sure what happens, because actually here you have to conserve also angular momentum. And it's possible that under some conditions you could get an helicoidal vortex line. But I'm not sure whether this is really the possibility. So we are now doing some variational calculations to see whether this helicoidal line appears when you touch the rotor. As I say, this is a work in progress. I just wanted to comment it here.
How much of it depends upon the VC? I mean, so presumably would you get all the same in the classical bipolar liquid where you've done this trick with the averages?
You have the vortex here, which is quantized.
Presumably why it's called a Kelvin.
Yes. Actually, this comes from the times of Thomson, where there was no condensate or whatever. Yes. This is true. But I believe that this particular analysis that I'm doing here, it doesn't demand very quantum physics, because actually this is a sort of very classical argument which I was saying here. Yeah. So I think that the rotation is actually a sort of general feature which appears in dipolar, but here is very much motivated by the trap, whereas here, basically what you have is that your one-dimensional system is your core, if you want to think it in this way. Okay, so this is something that you can have with dipoles. Other thing that you can have with dipoles is that you can generate Bose-Haber Hamiltonians with long-range interactions. Because actually, I would like to make a point in the next slide, what you do in order to get the Bose-Haber Hamiltonian is that you you take your original Hamiltonian and you project it into the basis of the Banier function, which are not exactly like this. They have also some tails, but you have some Banier function here in this side and in the other side and so on. So you basically project your original Hamiltonian into this basis, and this gives you the Bose-Haber Hamiltonian. If you don't have dipole-dipole interaction, and you just take the leading terms, then you will have the tunneling term and the on-site interactions. But if you take long-range interaction, then you can have also nearest neighbor or next nearest neighbor interactions and so on. Density, density. These coefficients here are given by these integrals with where these are the Banier functions. And then one can see that the on-site interaction is just provided by the short range interaction and the dipole-dipole interaction, whereas the other terms of next nearest neighbor interaction and so on are just provided by the dipolar interaction. So this means that by controlling the ratio between dipolar and short range interaction, which you can control by first part resonances, for example, by this sort of scattering resonance that I was commenting before, then you can have a control in particular of this ratio, U1 over U0, which if I remember correctly, U1 over U0 of the order of 1/4 is enough to stabilize the super solid, for example. So you can stabilize the super solid phase by controlling the dipole-dipole interaction. And this can be done by controlling how these integrals actually are. And this can be done by, for example, you have a two-dimensional configuration and you change the transversal confinement, and this, due to the anisotropy, will change also the result of these integrals, and therefore can change the ratio between U1 and U0. And then you can have superfluid, motor insulator, supersolid, charge density wave, and even more complicated phases, which as the ones which have been discussed recently, like this Haldane-Bose insulator, which is a system which has a non-local order parameter. But let me comment something that can occur even before you can have this. And it's the following thing. When you project your original Hamiltonian into the basis of the Banier functions, you have more terms than that. You have more terms than just simply the nearest neighbor interaction or next nearest neighbor interaction and so on. You will have additional terms, and one of them, which can give an interesting physics, is what I call here the collisionally induced tunneling. So it's a term in which you tunnel from the site J to the site I, but this depends non-linearly of the number of atoms that you have there. So it's not the same to tunnel if you are alone, if this atom is alone here, or is in the presence of other terms. And this is this element, which is here, this coupling constant here. This term is similar to something which occurs in frustrated magnetism, which is called correlated hopping. The difference is that in correlated hopping, you have three sites involved. So the tunneling between this site and this site depends on what is in the middle. This is what is called correlated hopping. And this is something which has been studied recently, especially by the group of Frederick Miller. And it has been shown that it can lead to the absence of single particle Bose-Einstein condensation at low densities with the presence of pairing. So this means that you can have pair superfluidity there in absence of single particle superfluidity. So there is a sort of transition between pair superfluidity and single particle superfluidity, but there has been now recent analysis with quantum Monte Carlo in which you can have also phase separation. But the phase separation can be stabilized, so this pair superfluidity can be stabilized against phase separation using this term.
So J tilde is going to be very tiny compared to the other term.
This J tilde of here, it depends on how do you do it. But in principle, you have, of course, a term which is, this is exponentially smaller than this one, but the fact that you have the exponential depends on the particular situation. And in particular, in the case of the dipole-dipole interaction, you have to realize that U2, for example, is U1 divided by 8 in square lattices. Yes? So the next nearest neighbor interaction is U1 divided by 8 because you have a 1 over R cubed dependence. And this ratio between J tilde and U1 can be comparable to this 1 over 8. So this means that this term, which appears here, this J tilde, can be comparable under reasonable experimental situations.
Sorry, what, where is U2?
U2 will be in the dots here.
Yeah. But it's still much smaller than the other terms in that.
It will be smaller than this term, This term is controllable independently, so this can be put to zero. And this is also controllable independently, so this can be put to zero. And actually, it's quite important to compare this term with that term over there, because they are the two tunneling. So the point is that with short-range interaction, and this is an important point, with short-range interaction, in principle, I could have also all these terms, but they are very small. And if I want to make this term comparable to that term, then I will make this term so big, in general, that I will go out of the single-band approximation. With the type of an interaction, I can control this term independently. So I can keep it small, but make this term comparable to that one. And then is when I can be in the business of all this collisionally induced hopping. So as I say, this is also something that we are now in progress.
Is that
yes. This is the recent paper in which they analyzed the phase separation versus per superfluid. So basically, just from the theoretical point of view, what one can do here is a sort of, which is done here, and basically we were following the same path. We can do a mean field analysis of this problem, you can make a mean field, homogeneous mean field, so to say, just for homogeneous phases, and then you see the appearance of this pair superfluidity. We have seen it, if you forget this term, we have seen it already, and now we are including also these terms. Okay, and now let me point some other control issues. First of all, just in general, and then also for the dipole-dipole interaction. So in principle, you can have a two-dimensional optical lattice, and in the third direction, which is this direction here, I will assume that there is a loose trapping. So this means that now I have like one-dimensional systems here. But actually, I can split each one of these one-dimensional systems using lattice, super-lattice techniques, in two wells. This has been done recently in experiments by the group of Bill Phillips, that you can split each well in two wells. So you can, if now you analyze what happens if in these wells, which can, the two sides are close and the other two sides are farther away, then you can isolate each one of these couple tubes here. You can put a third lattice in this direction. And then what you have is the equivalent of a ladder. So you can engineer ladders in this with these ideas. You can engineer ladders also with other ideas. Now, what happens if you put atoms in these ladders and you put a potential barrier which is very strong between the two ladders? Then what happens is that the atoms are in principle disconnected from each other. There is no hopping between the wires. And in principle, if there is no dipolar interaction, then you will have completely independent wires. So you will have the blue wire and the red wire, the two and the one wire, and they are living in different universes, let's say. If you add the dipolar interaction, then you will have a non-local coupling between these two and these two, for example, or between sides at the same leg, at the same wire, or even in diagonal, or even further terms. So we are analyzing now what happens with if you add all these terms. But let me consider now the terms that we have already discussed in this paper, which is what happens if you just have tunneling in the wire, on-site interaction in the wire, in each wire, and you have some attractive interaction between these sides, and so on. Similar ideas have been studied recently by Dembler and by Wang. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian that I have here. So this is, apart from this term, this is just doubling the Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian with two species, one and two. And this term is coupling the two. So basically this is the same as having just two bosonic components, so I just have one wire. Not two wires, but just one wire, but with two components. I can call in the wire red and the wire blue, but also the atoms blue and the atoms red, so to say. There have been a lot of activity in two components, and I just cited here several papers of that. Of course, this analogy is just true if the tunnelings are the same for both components and if the interactions are also the same. You have, and for this particular case that I will discuss here, they will have even the same chemical potential. In that case, this was studied by several authors, in particular by Svistov, Prokofiev, and Kukulov. then you can have different phases here. You can have the mode insulator phase, where these two order parameters are zero. And you can have, and here you have a commensurate number of atoms per site for both components. You have 1-1 or 2-2 or 3-3. You can have the what they call here the two superfluid phase, or the penetrable superfluids, where this order parameter is different than zero. So they just simply penetrate each other. And you have the per superfluid, where this order parameter is zero, and but this order parameter is different than zero. So it's similar to what I was discussing before in the correlated topic. Okay. So the point that I would like to make here is to analyze how the Mott insulator phases for these in principle disconnected wires change if I take into account this this pain mechanism. So if I have this interaction. So in principle, if I don't have interaction between the wires, I just have this Mott insulator superfluid phase diagram that I was commenting before. This is just for the first lobe. So you will have here the second lobe, the third lobe, and so on. And this is for zero atoms. But if you add the interaction between the wires, which is attractive, then you can have, in the phase diagram, regions in which you have per superfluid, two superfluid, and Mott insulator. And actually, you can have a direct transition between the Mott insulator and the per superfluid.
What is red and blue?
Red and blue. Red is the separation between Mott insulator and per superfluid, and blue is the separation between per superfluid and two superfluid. Actually, how this separation is done, basically we look to this order parameter. This is done in 1D, so you will say me that these order parameters are zero in the thermodynamic limit, but here I am considering a finite size system. So how this is done, basically you look to the two order parameters that I was commenting now. And you can have actually even a region here, which is what I call, I didn't put here, this is a sort of coexistent region where both order parameters can be different than zero. Yeah? Okay, but the important point here that I want to make is how the Mott insulator regions look like. Because the Mott insulator regions change the shape, and this will have important consequences for the experiments, I believe, if you have these uncoupled wires and also for two-component system. And this is because you have a direct Mott insulator to per superfluid transition. And this, for the lowest lobes of the Mott insulator, for low occupation, can have very important consequences. I must say that this analysis of Kuklov, Svistunov, and Prokofiev is, again, with this quantum phase model, and therefore it cannot have a look to this low occupations. So, in order to understand why this can be interesting, let's have a look to why the Mott insulator lobes look like they look. Because they look like they look because this boundary here is, when I go out of the Mott insulator, I go out by creating single particle or single holes in the problem. Which, if I have unconnected wires, so I have this U prime equal to zero, they will be just uncorrelated creation of particles and holes, so as if they were alone, these wires. So these lobes can be calculated actually using a strong coupling expansion to any degree if you are patient enough. Yes. And then you obtain these lobes. But in the case of direct Mott insulator to per superfluid transition, what you have is that you go out of the Mott insulator not by creating one particle and one hole, but by creating two particles and two holes correlated to each other. And this has important consequences in how the shape of the Mott insulator looks like. You can calculate it again with the strong coupling expansion. Of course, you see that now the first contribution is always quadratic in the tunneling because you have to tunnel two at the same time, or two holes at the same time. But as you see, this changes very much the shape of the Mott insulator, and actually changes very much the shape of the lowest boundary, which can be very important for experiments, actually. Yes? No, go.
I was just going to say, so it changes the nature of the transition at the tip of the lobe.
At the tip of the lobe, we didn't have a look, because this is much more complicated in this case.
Is the way you're drawing this new shape of the Mott lobe, is it really rounded?
In the calculations that we have to look, due to finite size effects, probably yes. If you include larger and larger systems, probably you will see some more sharp feature.
Because the
the shape, the shape.
Yeah.
The fact that it has this cusp, this is not an accident. This is because
it's a one dimension.
It's a
custom
story.
Yes.
It is a cusp because
it is a custom transition. Yeah, and here you have also some reentrant, small reentrant phase here. Yeah.
So you lose that when you do the pair, you lose that.
We don't observe this, no. But as I say, what happens here at the course is very difficult to see. I don't have here the figures, but due to finite size, actually you get a channel here, because you have always a sort of finite size gap here due to this. So it's very difficult to see what happens with that. So basically these calculations we did with DMRG but finite size, so it's different. So as I say, this changes the shape and actually can even make a reentrant configuration. But this reentrant configuration is different than the reentrant configuration that we're talking right now, because this just happens here at the tip of the lobe, and this happens from the very beginning here from the small tunnel. And actually, just from these strong coupling expansion calculations analytically, one can see that this change of the slope, inversion of the slope of the lowest boundary, will occur for the lowest mod insulator lobes, for one atom per side or two atoms per side. But it will occur also in two-dimensional lattices, because one can do this analysis not in coupled wires, but in coupled planes, yes? And actually, you can have lattices here with different coordination numbers, but the important thing is how these prefactors here actually look like. And this is independent of the coordination numbers, so you can have also this reentrant in 2D, which is something that you don't have in the usual case. And this, as I say, has important consequences, I think, for the experiments, because as I said before, when you make an experiment, you have always an overall trap, and this overall trap is setting you a local chemical potential. So if you fix a given tunneling and you are in this local chemical potential, when you increase the tunneling, you reduce the portion of cake, so to say, that you have of the mod insulator. And this is the intuitive picture, that when you increase the mobility, you will decrease the insulating character. But if your mod insulator lobe is flat, for example, here in the lowest boundary, which happens in this value, this means that when you increase the tunneling, your mod insulator regions can become insensitive to it. And they can even grow due to this reentrant phase. They can even grow. So this is a sort of counterintuitive behavior of the mod insulator when the hopping increases, because you increase the mobility and you make the system apparently more insulated. But again, this is due to the pairing that you have there. Okay, and now let me just finish quickly with some comments related with another tool that you have in cold gases. So we have seen the disorder, we have seen the dipole-dipole interaction, and I would just like to finish by mentioning the internal structure, because the atoms can have an internal structure. Yes? So you can have atoms in more than one internal level, and therefore you can have like a spin in this, a pseudo-spin. If you have two levels, this is equivalent to spin 1/2, 3 colors is like a spin 1, 5 colors is a spin 2, and you can have even cases of a spin 3, which is again, the case of chromium, which is a remarkable Bose-Einstein condensate experiment.
Oh, but the first one, real spin, right?
This one?
All but the first one. It's real spin. I mean,
so let's do this one. Yes. This is true. But in principle, I can think in other configurations which I can also play the same games. Yeah. But it's true. These are real spin.
In what sense the first one is real spin?
Because these are two different F states, for example.
But the rest of them is probably also
S. This is F1 different MFs. This is F2 with different MFs. And actually, this is a spin 3. Here, there is no nuclear spin in chromium, right?
In the first one, you pick just some particular projections of F. That's the
yes. This was done in the first experiments of Cornell and Weimann in Chile. And for this particular experiment, it was done with magnetically trapped rubidium. And it just by chance, these two see the same trap. The revolution in spinor came from the optical trapping. Because with optical traps, basically what you do is you trap atoms in a laser field. Yes? And by doing this, you can trap different magnetic states at the same time. You do it with a magnetic trap, the Zeeman effect is different for the different MF states, right? So this liberated the spin degree of freedom. And this, as I say, led to to novel physics in the ground state phases and in the spin dynamics. Basically, the ingredients for understanding the spinor systems are these three. You have the single particle physics, in which you have basically the Zeeman effect. You can also have the quadratic Zeeman effect, but I didn't comment on this because, for example, in chromium it doesn't occur, but I will say something about this in a second. So basically you have this linear dependence of the energy. You have the short range interactions, which is what I commented at the beginning of the talk. You have short range interactions. The short range interactions are isotropic. So they are like a sphere, so you don't mix. If you enter with some projection, n plus n prime, you go with the same projection, n plus n prime. But of course, if you enter, for example, in two blue states, for example, in minus 3 with minus 3, for example, better to say, if you enter with minus 3 and 3, for example, minus 3 and 3 is 0. So you can get 0 with different combinations, minus 3 with 3, minus 2 with 2, minus 1 with 1, or 0 with 0, and this gives you different scattering channels in the problem with different scattering lengths. On the contrary, the dipole-dipole interaction, and here I come back to the second part of the talk, the dipole-dipole interaction is anisotropic and therefore mixes the different spins that you have there, and it's not necessary in a collision given by the dipole-dipole interaction that you have this conservation. And actually, this leads to the possibility to transfer spin into center of mass angular momentum, as I will comment in a second. So basically, the ground state of spinor systems can be very rich. With the spin 1, you can have a ferromagnetic and a polar phase. With the spin 2, you can have ferromagnetic, polar, cyclic. And actually, with the new classifications introduced by by Jim Demler and collaborators, actually this has been called now nematic and tetrahedral or something like that. Probably you know it all. Okay. In spin 3, you can have much more complicated physics. And actually, as it was pointed out by Roberto Diner and Jason Ho, you can have the equivalent of uniaxial and biaxial pneumatics, uniaxial and biaxial spin pneumatics, which, on the point of view, is very nice because it links the physics of cold gases also with the physics of liquid crystals, which I think is very is very interesting. I never thought in my life that I was going to work in something like with crystals, I must confess, and this is something very, very interesting. For this biaxial pneumatics, basically you have to calculate this tensor here. These are the spin components, and you have to see the eigenvalues of this tensor. If these eigenvalues are 1 different and 2 the same, this is the equivalent of a uniaxial pneumatics, because basically you have like a cylindrical symmetry. So basically you have two eigenvalues which are the same, two directions which give you the same eigenvalue, and one which is different. So this is like a uniaxial, like a cylinder. It has the symmetry of a cylinder. In the axial, you have three different eigenvalues. Okay. Other thing that you can have in spinor systems with the dipole-dipole interaction is that, as I say, if you have just the short range part, if you are with two blue atoms, for example, in the minus 3, minus 3 with minus 3 just can give you minus 3 with minus 3. So this is forbidden. But the spin relaxation allowed by the dipole-dipole interaction, which I commented right now, allows you to transfer between this side and this side. But if by doing that you preserve the... Hi. You preserve the cylindrical symmetry, then you have to conserve the angular momentum in the problem. So since you violate the spin, you have to transfer this spin into center of mass angular momentum. And this is the equivalent of this famous, celebrated Einstein-de-Haas effect of 1915. There are some problems to observe this, but I will not enter into that. And my last comment is just related with another possibility of control that you have in dipolar, in spinor systems, which is the following. You can generate a linear or quadratic Zeeman effect independently of the magnetic field. And how this can be done, I will tell you right now. So this is the ground state of chromium, 7s3 here, just 7 states. This is an excited state, p state. So you can connect these two by dipole allowed transitions. For example, you can take a laser with a polarization, linear polarization, which will couple you the -3 state with the -3 state, the -2 with the -2, and so on. If you do it very far away from resonance here, if the tuning here is very big, this transition is just virtual, so it's a second order process. So you go from your M state to some intermediate state, which actually has to have the same M, but now it's in the upper state. Let's call it excited state. This is the ground state. And ground in the M state. And now you have to divide here basically by the tuning that you have there. So what you see is that these states of here get a shift. And this shift is this AC star shift, which is just the second order process correction to the energy, which is basically provided by the intensity of your laser, the tuning, but also through this matrix element of here. And this matrix element of here happened to be dependent on M linearly. So if you take in the square, it depends on M in the square. So this means that you can have a quadratic Zeeman effect. But now this quadratic Zeeman effect, contrary to the usual Zeeman effect, is not dependent on the magnetic field in the square. It's independent. So it's a different tool. I can play with it independently of the magnetic field. And this can be, for example, space dependent, because I can play with it. So this opens a lot of possibilities, I think. Actually, similar ideas have been explored in the context of microwave dressing in optical lattices by the group of Manuel Bloch. And then the system that you can have here, it can be very rich. So this is the magnetic field in some units, and this is this quadratic Zeeman effect. And you can have different phases with different symmetries in here, which actually can be classified also using this classification of introduced by Eugene Daimler's group. But one of the points that I would like to make here is that by changing this quadratic Zeeman effect, you can change between phases, you can make points through phase transitions between phases of different symmetries. So you can induce topological defects in the systems, in the system, and so on. Basically, this is something that we would like to study in the next future. Okay. I would say first order, yeah. But as I say, the main point here is that I will quench through this phase transition, which has very different symmetries. And what are the topological defects that I generate there is something which is not completely clear for me, something that we would like to study. But basically, this is a new tool that you can really use to change between one side and the other. Okay. And with this, I would like to finish. So I hope that I show you that you can have different possibilities of control of these systems. I was very general, so if you want that I tell you more things in detail, I will be here all the next week. But we have seen that you can generate disorder, for example, in optical lattices in different ways. And this has particular consequences, like, for example, disappearance of this tricritical point that I was commenting before. And you can have also dipole-dipole interaction in addition to the short range interaction, which can lead you to these rotons, not only this phonon roton spectrum, but also this Kelvin roton spectrum here. You can engineer different quantum phases by just changing the parameters of the lattice using the properties of the dipole-dipole interaction. The dipole-dipole interaction can lead to the collisional induced tunneling, so terms which are not irrelevant, actually. And it can lead to the distortion of Modemot insulator lobes and to these counterintuitive effects that I was commenting before if you have a direct Mott insulator to pair superfluid transition. And in the spinors, the dipole-dipole interaction can lead to the Einstein-Dehaas effect. You can have different quantum phases. And you can induce with a laser a quadratic Zeeman effect which can really be a very interesting tool for analyzing different physical scenarios in the next future. And with this, I would like to thank the people who worked with me in Hanover, and especially the group of Thurman Fowler in Stuttgart, and especially Maciej Levenstein and George Lev. Thank you very much.